of Real Guys Talk Real Sports. We will raise market game changers. Start to get real. These are the kind of guys I need to have in the locker room. The championship type guys. Certain guys, you just got to recognize, I got to pay the money. I got to keep it. Everybody has an opinion.
They came with so much bravado and so much swagger.
We'll make excuses. We're not going to make excuses. Sometimes you got to create space where there's no space.
I can't argue with LeBron's kids.
I do have a game of problem with execution. Right?
He burned it. A lot of bridges. He's going to be hated in Chicago. He's going to be hated in Cleveland. He's going to be hated in New York. And that's what I'm excited to see.
I blame it on Nintendo. I blame it on the fact that they never played against a team that's going to be as dominant as this team could be.
The true villain team. The team that everybody wants to smack in the mouth every time they play them.
All right, welcome to the Real Sports Guys, where real guys talk real sports, RSG, Renegade Radio. If you were here last week, if you didn't get a chance to listen to the show last week, it was a landmark show. We went way in. We had incredible guests. The energy was off the hook. It's just incredible stuff that was going on, and we're going to have the Game Changer join us later on. You know, that's the thing about Real Sports Guys. You know, we're leading workshops. We're doing all kinds of stuff. You know, he's leading some stuff this evening, and so he's going to join us about 9. But it's myself, Phil T., the prophet, the doctor, is in the house. Phil, talk to the people.
Hey, happy to be here with you, man, tonight. You know, you tried to call me the Jet last week, and I shunned him. I said I was more like the microwave, but, you know, I might have to come in like the Jet. He didn't prove himself, so call me the Jet this week.
You had the tattoo on the arm and everything. You brought it all last week. We got a lot going on this week, you know, we're going to kind of be all over the place, and then we got a special treat the second part of the show. We're going to get into some real good stuff. For you true basketball fans, you enjoy the conversation we'll have later on in the show. But we're going to kick it off with a little bit of funky editorial. You know how we do it. You know, they got me on the ones and twos.
Fellas, one thing we need to say. Shall we say it, y'all? Melvin, right. Jimmy, Coleman, Ryan, say it. Everybody want to get funky one more time.
That's the funky editorial. Our funky editorial this week is around the U.S. Open in golf. You know, some of you probably had a chance to watch Rory hold on to it after struggling in the Masters, having a lead. You know, it looked like he might have had that Greg Norman reputation developing. He closed the deal. He closed the deal the U.S. Open. You know, there's still a lot of debate about the course, but the real big part of the discussion is, you know, there's kind of like, you know, we all kind of learned a lot when Jordan retired. Everybody was looking for the next Jordan. And now that Tiger's kind of struggling and is ailing and people don't know if he can really catch Jack, you know, every young golfer that comes out is like, is he the next Tiger? And, you know, what I want to talk about and get Phil T's, you get your input on, is can there be a next Tiger? You know, in some ways, Tiger was bigger than the game. You know, Tiger transcended golf. That was what made him interesting. Not that he was a great player, but he was somebody who, because of who he was physically, in terms of what he physically looked like, in terms of race and everything else, just created a different dynamic in golf. And can someone replace him? What do you think?
Well, I think it's an interesting discussion. You know, first of all, the young man, McElroy, he had a great weekend, record-setting weekend. I certainly take my hat off to him. You know, I think it's too early, though. I think it's too early to anoint him as the future of golf. You know, I think he certainly, his performance, you know, this season, specifically this past weekend, really, you know, opens the door to the conversation. But it's a bit too early. We need to see, you know, a solid season or two of work to really take a step back and see how he compares to Tiger. You know, like you mentioned, Tiger brought a whole lot of stuff to the table, you know, in terms of his race, that went beyond the golf course and his actual performance. So in my opinion, it's a little bit too early. You know, the thing about Tiger, Tiger didn't become Tiger until he had been doing it for a little bit, you know, until he had a couple of solid years. And then all of a sudden we took a step back and said, wow, I mean, this, you know, this guy's had record-setting tournaments at the Masters and the British Open. All of a sudden, like, wow, you know, this guy has potential to be one of the greats. But that was only after a couple of years where he had put together a couple of record-setting runs in terms of the majors and just tournaments in general. So again, I think it's a little bit too early to put him in the Tiger class quite yet.
Yeah, I think they, and I don't remember statistics exactly, but I think in the same number of tournaments, their first tournaments, I don't know if it was the first 100 tournaments or something like that, Tiger had already had like 27 victories. And McIlroy has like, I don't know if it's like 7, 8, or, you know, I don't know, whatever he has on the European tour. So, I mean, even, I don't think people realize, you know, what Tiger did coming out the gate just in playing golf. But as you were talking about, being the Tiger means transcending sports. You know, no one was like Michael Jordan. Part of what made Michael was because Michael transcended basketball. And I don't know if McIlroy can do that. He could be a great golfer. I think he can win a lot of tournaments. He won a lot of majors. But does he have that compelling story that makes you an icon? And that's yet to be seen. And I guess it gets back to what you're saying. It's too early. You know, we have this in the microwave generation in which we live, where we have the Twitter world, not even a microwave, it's like the Twitter world and everything else, that people aren't patient anymore about and letting people develop their greatness. How do you feel about that?
You know, I'm right with you. You know, with Serena Williams coming back to the Wimbledon, as well as her sister, I started thinking about just how they impacted tennis, you know, 10, 12 years ago when they first hit the scene. And, you know, my mother, my father, my older siblings, you know, all in their 40s, 50s, 60s, they grew up with tennis. My generation, tennis, like, we really weren't up on tennis until the Williams sisters came about, where, you know, you think about some of the past African-American greats in tennis, like Althea Gibson, Arthur Ashe. I mean, that was a generation in the 60s, 70s, and 80s that was, you know, encaptured with tennis. And then there was kind of this gap, you know, and that's the same thing that happened with Tiger, you know, like what the Williams sisters did in tennis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, the kid now from Ireland that had this great tournament, we can't really expect for him to have that same impact that Tiger had, you know, because Tiger, he had Cedric the Entertainer talking about golf.
That's right.
I mean, you know, Cedric said it right. You know, we'd be on the golf course, but we kind of be wrong when we go, but Tiger had us so fired up that we wanted to go. You know, it was something we wanted to do. You know, we got our kids involved with it. And, you know, start taking golf lessons. I mean, we can't expect anybody else to do that because there were so many other dynamics outside of what happened on the golf course.
Like brothers in the hood walking in with cut-off blue jean shorts with a baseball cap.
That's like, right.
Well, I'm swinging for the fence. You know, that's it. I mean, you had cats who you never thought would think about golf out there with their golf gear on. And, like, my one guy, I mean, here, his son, I think, is ranked nationally and start to play golf. I mean, he's a young kid, and you know, he's probably, you know, he might be that guy. So some of those kids are, that some of these folks are beginning to work with are only 7, 8, 9, 10. You know, they've been putting the golf club in their kids' hands and never even thought about doing that until they saw what Earl Woods did with Tiger. And you know, but the fortune that, you know, but at our college where we went to school, you know, to have a professor there who knew Tiger's family and was able to be able to talk about, you know, Tiger behind the scenes and his family. But, you know, just the discipline and everything that creates who he is. I mean, the way he was raised, and I'm not going to say this in a negative way, but the way and the intensity and the focus he developed over his lifetime and, you know, seeded what we saw in his behavior in a way, you know, because – he was just so focused, didn't have a lot of time for a lot of stuff, and, you know, didn't allow him to develop other aspects of his life. Rory doesn't seem like that kind of guy. They describe him as this kind of likable guy. You know, he kind of gets along with everyone. When they describe him, they talk about his swing, you know. But to me, a lot of the great icons are flawed, personally, in some way. Michael Jordan had flaws. Personality flaws, whether it was gambling, whether it was whatever, they flawed. You know, they like a train wreck waiting to happen, but they're great. And when I look at Rory, I don't get that feeling that he carries that kind of greatness. He's going to win it, but he's not going to win it in, like, I think he's not going to be James Dean. He's not going to be, you know, like, you know, great with a flaw and waiting for a wreck to happen. He doesn't seem like that kind of guy. And that, I think that's part of being an icon. That's the LeBron. That's the... You come with something that is like a yin and a yang. And
well, I think Rory does have a chance to become that because,
yeah.
you know, I was just looking at the top 50 earning athletes, and Phil Mickelson is either one or two.
Yeah.
you know, and he doesn't win very often. But, I mean, that goes to show how hungry the golf game is for a face, especially
yeah.
with Tiger kind of being down and out, right? Well, I won't say out because I think he'll come back stronger than ever, but he's down right now, and that spot's kind of open for all the sponsorships. I mean, there's, man, it's crazy money out there for golf pros.
But do you think that, like, even Mickelson, do you see him as being an iconic sports figure? Like,
No, but if he goes on a run and wins a few tournaments in a, you know, in a year or two, he can become that, and Rory can do that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Where, I mean, I get what you're saying, that I don't see this kid turning into a Jordan, but after Jordan won his first championship, we didn't, I mean, most of us didn't see Jordan turn into what he turned into.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's one of those things where you have to really see somebody's body of work take a step back.
Mm-hmm.
And say, wow, I mean, this dude's doing it. I mean, he's really getting it done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how he does in his next major. He can put some stuff together. You know, can he appeal? And I'm wondering is part of it that he's not an American? You know, it'll be, you know, interesting to see how that plays in terms of his ability to, you know, have a broader brand, you know, because, you know, he's not American. I mean, they got like you have 11 different champions, how many is number runs where we've been since Americans won a major. And so, you know, even just looking at what's happening with American golf, you know, in the same way we've seen Americans fall off, particularly in men's tennis, and what's that done to the, you know, popularity of it. So, you know, can he be that icon and not be American, you know, and play on Madison Avenue? That's going to be another variable in terms of how people gravitate to him. So that's what we got to say about golf. We've had our golf interlude. We've done enough with the golf. We're going to get a little bit of the NFL, not much. You know, we're finding that with the NFL right now, it looks like they're turning the corner on a deal. And I guess the way I want to look at this right now, you know, let's imagine a deal gets done by July 4th.
Yeah.
And everything's open for business. Kind of given what you know, we got some key players out there. We got Ocho out there, potential trade opportunity. We've got, a couple of players. Obviously we don't know what's happening with, Miami and what they're going to do. People have done things with their draft, but as you look at this right now, let's say it ends July 4th, which is anticipated. Which teams do you see need to make some moves right away?
Well, I look more at the position, and there are a ton of teams out there that have a need at quarterback.
Mm-hmm.
There's some decent, serviceable, borderline guys that can make a difference, quarterbacks out there, that they're kind of in limbo, whether with contract issues or teams have publicly said that, we want to make a move. You think about McNabb, you think about Hasselbeck, you think about
Cobb.
Carson Palmer.
Yep.
Yeah, Cobb. I mean, there are a lot of quality quarterbacks out there that can really, be the missing piece for a team. I'm interested to see what happens with the Carson Palmer situation.
Mm-hmm.
Because, these guys, Carson as well as Brown, the GM out there, they're kind of staring down, trying to figure out who's going to blink first. Personally, I think the Bengals should move on. They should move on, let them go, try to get as much value as they can get back. Obviously you try to negotiate, you try to appease him, and the cat does not want to be there anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Make a move, get something back. Personally, I think the Bengals, especially making the playoffs 2 years ago, I think it's sad because I think they were only a couple of players away from being a contender again in a really tough division.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin Cobb is another situation I think is really enticing. I think in the right situation, he can be a pretty darn good quarterback. Maybe not playing at the Pro Bowl level, but, put him around a solid defense as well as, a good running game. I'm thinking the 49ers. I'm thinking the Cardinals. Put some weapons around him. He can be a difference maker, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I like Brown, the owner for the Bengals, always – been tough on people who've been asking for trades. But there comes a time in every organization where you take a different strategy, a different way. And I agree with you saying, I think Palmer's productivity has gone down. And, what if you were able to, could you move him for McNabb? you can have an older guy, but, McNabb might be all right in Cincinnati. I just think you're right that they need to figure out how to move on because they're at a point right now where they got enough other pieces and Palmer was sometimes, I hate to say it, the reason why they lost games last year. And you would have never said that before last year. And so, that's why I'm wondering why he's complaining now. There were years where he probably could have complained. But last year, he was probably more the reason why they lost than anything. I mean, there were open throws he normally would make that he just wasn't making. And so they were able to establish somewhat of a running game. They got a young tight end, so they got some pieces offensively. If they had, if they committed to running the football a little bit more again like they did 2 years ago, they committed to, developing routes for a tight end position. Whatever they decide to do with Ocho Cinco, if they go to trading, allow some of the young receivers to step up, I think they're at a point transitionally that it might not be a bad thing to do. Cobb, I think that puts them in a really good position to try to make some things happen with Cobb. I think Cobb, you know, Cobb is like having that insurance piece. I mean, they could do whatever they want to do. They could play him anyway. I mean, Philadelphia is in a really good position, and particularly when you got a short startup with your season. I think teams like Philadelphia, Green Bay, some of those teams that tend to try to that work a lot through the draft and they use free agency very strategically are going to be in great position. So they kind of got a wild card with Cobb. And then, you know, Washington is a mess. And I just want to get McDonovan out of there just because he just needs to get out of there. I mean, I don't care where he goes. Send him to Buffalo. Anything got to be better than being DC. You know, I'm just like, I'm writing letters in support of Donovan. Just moving to something. Moving to the USL or UFL, whatever they call it, league. Moving to Canada. Anything to get him out of what he was in last year. I mean, no Hall of Fame caliber quarterback like that needs to go through what he's going through. And then I think about San Francisco in their quarterback situation, you know, having Alex Smith. I mean, I think they're in position to be a recipient. You know, so I think teams like, you know, San Francisco could benefit from this. I mean, Palmer possibly to San Francisco might not be a bad play. And they got some young players that, you know, someone like Cincinnati could get back some talent. Hasselbeck, you mentioned. I don't think he's done. I just think they've been bad in recent years to the extent that I think he got at least 1 or 2 years in him, you know. So if he's the kind of guy that could end up in a Minnesota or something like that, I just think he has some. I think he has a couple of years in him. I just think he it just hasn't been a good situation for him recently in Seattle. I think the quarterback position. I think the receiver position is so undervalued because of the way they let you play defense now that right. You know, a guy like Ochu is not going to be able to make the kind of money he can make. And be the kind of value he can be. The running back position, again, is all these positions probably like 5 or 6 years ago we would probably be talking about are just so undervalued right now. And so it's hard to talk about that. But I do think this right now is about the teams who build their team for the draft are going to be the contenders this year.
I look at that DB out there in Oakland, 21, Asamaga, I think is how you say his name.
Yeah.
Widely regarded as, you know, a top five corner, if not the top corner in the game right now. And you look at how Revis dominates and, you know, with the Jets in New York. And this guy has a similar impact of the game. Imagine, you know, because he's also a free agent. He's a top free agent out there.
Yeah.
Imagine if he signs with a team like the Houston Texans, who couldn't stop anybody last year, primarily because of their defensive backfield, where, I mean, they had guys that can get to the quarterback, but they didn't have guys who could cover. You know, I mean, think about that team with that very solid offense with Adrian Foster, with Schaub at quarterback. You got a good tight end. You got Andre Johnson. And now all of a sudden you got a defense back there that won't give up 30 points a game. Maybe they'll give up 20. Maybe they'll give up 17. And all of a sudden, they got a couple of more wins, and they're a legitimate playoff team. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm interested to see where some of these top-tier free agents are going to land.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a game changer. You know, anytime you can get a defensive back, I said that, too. Timing's right. Game changer probably be in a little bit. That's a game changer because I think that if you can basically cut off half the field, that changes how you can put more people in the box. You know, so a team like Houston can definitely benefit from some kind of free agent acquisition like that. You know, I'm getting bubbled up. It's one of the things about the NFL right now is though, I just flip right through the NFL channel. I just boycotted them all together for the most part. I try not to listen to anything. It just, you know, I don't know why I did it. I don't even stop at the NFL channel. So, you know, I know they feel the pressure, but I want to talk about it, but I can't talk about it. So we gave the NFL about as much as we're going to give them right now. One of the things I want to talk about, we haven't talked about as much baseball, but I do want to talk about Pujols and his injury and how you think it might affect negotiations. Because, you know, he had all kinds of leverage. You know, he's going to hold out, wait to the end of the season and deal there. He wants about an 8-year deal. You know, how do you feel like this might play out for him right now? Do you think it might impact him at all, or do you think it might have an impact on the length of his deal?
Well, I think it'll certainly have an impact on the length of his deal. But quite honestly, I don't know if he would have ever gotten, you know, a 9 or 10 year deal that he's looking for. But especially with the injury and, you know, just listening and reading, there's been a few guys that have had some wrist injuries and some shoulder injuries that it's really affected their power numbers. You know, coming off the injury and actually for the rest of their career, Cliff Floyd is a guy that's been spoken about quite a bit, as well as Albert Bell as well, where these guys had some serious wrist injuries, and all of a sudden their power numbers just came way down for the rest of their career. You know, for those who don't know, I live in the St. Louis area. We recently went to a St. Louis Cardinal baseball game, and, you know, I walked away thinking it's going to be really bad if Albert leaves. Because Albert is the face of that franchise, on the field, in the community. I mean, everybody loves Albert. You go to a Redbird game, and if it's 35,000 people there, you're going to see at least 15,000, 20,000 people that have on Pujols jerseys. You know, in my mind, I think it might be a mini LeBron James situation where you got the hometown kid that leaves. You know, obviously Albert's not from the St. Louis area, but, you know, he's had his entire career there. He's had monster success. And I think part of that is going to play into the type of offer he gets. Kind of like with Jeter, you know, I'm the biggest Derek Jeter fan out there, but, you know, he probably didn't deserve the money and the length of the contract that he got this past offseason, but he's the captain. He means a lot to that organization. That certainly played partly into it. I think that's going to be magnified with Pujols. Now, obviously, I don't think the team is going to put themselves in a situation where they're going to be handcuffed to have to give him, you know, a 7 to 10 year deal where they think of 4 or 5 maybe more fitting, so maybe they'll compromise on 6 or 7. But, you know, at this point, he was playing pretty solid. He's hitting 280. I think he was, you know, had around 45, 50 RBIs. And he had, I believe, 17 or 18 home runs.
Yeah.
So those are all-star numbers. They're not Albert-type numbers, but they're all-star-type numbers. So I think the other thing we need to look at is whenever he makes it back, whether it's after the all-star break, you know, or if he's only going to be out for a few weeks, we'll see. If he maintains those kind of numbers and they make the playoffs, I think he'll get his money. I think he'll get a 6-7 year deal averaging $20 to $30 million a year, which at a guy his age, you know, I think that's going to be what he's going to be looking at. And he's going to have to come down a little bit from that $30 million a year for 10 years. That's just not going to be out there unless he has a monster year when he comes back.
Yeah, and they're looking at him probably coming back in August, and if he's a fast healer, you're right. I mean, I think, you know, one thing about this is that, you know, in this day and age, we have a short memory. And, you know, if he has a, you know, he comes back, has a great stretch in August and September, they have a good postseason, and he matters, you're right. I think he's back in and he's able to leverage negotiations. You know, I think the length of the deal is going to be at question. I think people will settle around somewhere around 6 or 7. I think folks might go to 7 if it's the right deal. I think going beyond 7, I think it's diminishing returns. I mean, I think you're mortgaging too much of your franchise. You know, it's going to look good in the first couple of years, but, you know, if you want to sustain it over time, I think 6 or 7 years is probably about the right. I think it recognizes, you know, the performance he's had and the longevity. But at the same time, it allows you know, the franchise to really be able to plan for the long term. So, you know, whether it's the Cubs or whether it's St. Louis, but you're right, I think they built so much of their who they are, and St. Louis is a great sports town, particularly for baseball, around who he is. I think I think it'd be a deep depression if he left. And you know, he's not going to do the decision. I think he's handled it very professionally. I don't think, you know, but I think just the idea, particularly if he goes to the Cubs, I think that would create, you know, if he went to the Yankees or something like that, you know, which I don't think that are Red Sox, I think people would be mad, but it's out of the way. But if he went to the Cubs or something like that, I think it would be tough for him. So we'll see. We'll see how Albert does. We'll keep watching that. We'll keep posted, and you know, there's gonna be plenty of discussion about this stuff, so we'll have plenty of time. You know, baseball is a long season. We're gonna try to introduce a little bit more baseball into our conversation. I said I was gonna leave the NFL, but I did want to come back to one. Phil, you hear more about this Tiki Barber story. What's your opinion on this whole idea? I mean, Tiki's like LeBron, like I mean, in a sense, I mean, it's just like he is just like a lightning rod. Have you been following this story?
Yeah, I've been following it. It might be good to give our listeners an update of what's going on with Tiki.
Well, you know, Tiki Barber is deciding to come back to football. Yeah, and I mean, people have been speculating a lot about why he's coming back. You know, he obviously didn't continue his deal, and he wanted to be mainstream in terms of – that was his whole thing with media. He just didn't want to do sports media. He wanted to do mainstream stories. He wanted to do serious stories. And, you know, that career hasn't really panned out for him. And so he didn't get renewed, and then he decided to come back to football. And, you know, everyone knows that his departure from the Giants and then them going on to win the Super Bowl – and how critical he was on the run to the Super Bowl. So, particularly in New York, but around a long place, Tiki doesn't have, if we say, a good brand. He's not a popular guy. So now he's coming back, and everybody's speculating about why he's coming back and everything else. And then he recently said, you know, he's kind of talked about it and said, you know, he really needs football. Like, football doesn't need him. He really needs football. He talked about being, you know, depressed when he left football. And so he's really trying to personalize the story in a way that people have not really seen Tiki be kind of personal about it. So I think is that enough of it? You think I think I pretty much laid it out. So given that, what do you think?
Well, I think America loves a good story. So, you know, Tiki comes back and is a contributor. You know, I mean, I think there's a lot of teams out there that can use a quality third down back, which I have no doubt that, you know, that's something he could probably still do. Now, I don't know if he's a guy that you could give 15, 20, 25 carries a game, you know, like he could in the past. But, you know, I think in this day and age with athletes and the way they take care of themselves, it's kind of like with Michael Vick. I mean, he was away for a couple of years. You know, I mean, you can make the argument he comes back without really losing all those years in terms of productive years of playing football before Father Time catches up with you.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, I'm in Tiki's corner. You know, he had some personal issues, you know, that really, you know, I think contributed as well to him not getting renewed at NBC, I believe is where he was at.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm in his corner. I hope he can get things back on track. You know, because at the end of the day, he's just trying to, you know, do what he does, be a football player, and he wants to hold on to that as long as he can. So I hope it works out for him.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, he's going to really need to get with the right, you know, organization, you know, and I think that'll help a little bit with his image, depending on, you know, who he ends up with, you know. You know, you know, he's pretty much putting his story out there. He got his NBC, his marriage. He has a quote that, I mean, the only thing I felt right was The only thing that that felt right was Tracy. It was the only thing that made me not really feel depressed. So he's talking about, said that, his girlfriend and everything else. I mean, he put the whole personal thing out there. So this cat is going through something emotionally, out there. And it's one of them things where karma just is a mother, Skippy. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it's like, always think about, I always said, it matters as much how you leave as how you arrive. And when he left real shoddy. And, that karma, boy, that karma is just something that you just can't escape. But like you said, America loves. Go ahead.
I think he has to understand whatever team does give him a shot, that he can't walk in there with this superstar ego that he had. That he may have been entitled to and may have been accepted in the past.
That's right.
Coming into a locker room now, if I'm a teammate, I'm looking at him like, man, this dude, he kind of said some really shocking things, about some of his, about his past teammates, especially when his comments were relevant. First year, after he retired and they struggled in the beginning of the season, Peaky had everything to say about Eli's lack of leadership qualities. Mm-hmm. He had a lot of things to say about guys who didn't show up to play. He had a lot of things to say about the coach. So if I'm a team, I'm a little bit leery about bringing Tiki in, even though, like I mentioned, he brings a lot to the table. He's always been a fairly solid pass blocker. He's, he's had excellent hands in terms of catching the ball. I mean, obviously, he had some fumble issues. So, from a third down back, he can be a Chester Taylor, in my opinion. But you have to consider the baggage he's bringing in, where unfortunately, I think because of the things that's happened very recently since he retired, you kind of put Tiki in the category of an Ocho, of a T.O., of a guy that, he's got a lot of talent, but do I want to deal with all the drama?
That's right. And you have a strong enough veteran crew. You have a strong enough locker room, a Baltimore-type locker room where you got veterans already controlled and Tiki's just going to come in and fall in line. And, that's the kind of team you got to have. I mean, you can't have him messing with a young team. You can't have him in Tampa, right? Because they're too young. I know his brother down there, but they're too young. You can't have him in Tampa. So you can't have him around some young folks. But you got to have him in a locker room like New England. He might get it. He might be okay in New England. I can see Belichick taking a chance on him. You know what I'm saying? Because Belichick, he can leverage that us against the world. I can see him in New England with Belichick. He can be around Brady now because they got control of that. So it's going to take that kind of situation for him to go into. If he's going to be successful in. For the team to be successful. So it'll be a story we'll watch. Won't be on anybody's fantasy roster.
I think you bring up a lot of quality points concerning Tiki. I know we're going to transition to basketball here shortly for the second hour.
Yeah.
But there was one more football thing I wanted to bring up.
Okay.
That's kind of related to basketball. In the labor talks, it seems like they're kind of making the breakthrough and they're talking, the owners and the players. It seems like some concessions are being made on both sides and they're making progress.
Mm-hmm.
But what was really interesting to me was when I was watching SportsCenter earlier and they were kind of reporting what had happened today, right after that they showed David Stern with the NBA talking about the labor talks with the NBA.
Mm-hmm.
And quite honestly, the NBA seems, the NBA and its players, they seem to be overtly making an effort to show good faith and to be moving in the right direction. Because I think what's really going to help the game of basketball is the struggles that the NFL is having concerning their labor dispute.
Mm-hmm.
Because with the NFL being, three and a half months into their labor dispute, and with the NBA coming up on that deadline pretty soon, I think they're kind of getting a a pretty good taste of what can happen to the NBA with some of the issues that the NFL are kind of butted up against right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't be surprised if the NBA gets something done before their June 30th deadline,
mm-hmm.
you know, or shortly thereafter, you know, 15, 20 days after, because they don't want to get in the same situation that football is kind of flirting with.
And the NBA doesn't have that same cachet with the public as the NFL. The
right.
NBA, and that's why I think they need to get it done quickly, because the NBA, as popular it was for this playoff season, you know, we talk about all these dynamics. There's so much more, sometimes I feel like there's so much more resentment about what NBA players get versus other leagues. And so,
right.
you know, you don't have the sympathy of concussions and people dying from concussions and all those long-term injuries, even though there are some when you play basketball, as you have with football. You know, there. Every NBA fan can think of somebody on their roster that's overpaid. You know what I'm saying? You know, you don't feel that way with the NFL always, but every NBA team, every fan can look at their team and identify at least two or three players they know is overpaid. And that's where the players don't have a lot of leverage. You know, in some ways, the owners, if they wanted to, they could crush them. Other than the star players, they always have a system that's going to make the LeBrons happy. They always have a system that is going to make the Kobe's happy. But it's that mid-level player. It's that sixth man. It's that guy off the bench. It's that 10th, 11th, 12th man. It's that Derek Fisher. It's those cats who will end up paying the price. But I mean, from a public, because NBA is always good with the kind of the public relations. From a public relations standpoint, it makes all the sense in the world for them to get a quick deal done. From a business standpoint, that's where I'm wondering what the owners are like, you know, because they got a guy in their ranks that's like the guy for Carolina who says crush him. And I wonder how that's gonna play, you know, because they got to come up with a deal that's gonna allow the small market teams, you know, Oklahoma City owners are you know, they want to make sure they can keep Durant. They don't want to have what happened in Miami, you know. And so, you know, whatever deal they come down, it's got to be pleasing to the Golden State Warriors. It's got to work for the Milwaukee Bucks. It's got to work for the Minnesota Timberwolves. You know, those are the owners who are like, we got to make sure we got a system that allows us to keep our stars. And it might have to be something where it's like where you can put the tag on them, you know, and do it that way, you know, and you don't get penalized for paying them. You can put that tag on them and do it that way. They got to come up with something that will allow, you know, those mid-level teams in those small markets keep their stars.
I'm happy that neither the NFL or NBA seem to be going towards a baseball model.
Yeah.
I remember last year around this time listening to the show, Ray had mentioned that he hoped that never happened, where football and baseball start to look like baseball, where there's
mm-hmm.
no salary cap, where you know you can have a Yankees and you can also have a Pittsburgh Pirates. You know, that's not good for the game of baseball, and so you know, kind of like how Ray forecasted, I'm really happy that the NFL and NBA has not went in that direction either.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what I think what he was talking about. With you know, like Mara and folks like that. So I was with someone having that conversation about them. It was actually on Mike and Mike. I listened to a couple weeks ago. You know, making decisions that were good for the league. You know, when the NFL back in the 50s, 60s got the NFL money and the Giants would have been able to get the lion's share, but they could have been the Yankees. They decided to come up with a business model that worked for everyone. And so this whole debate about, you know, do you think about the interest of the game? You know, when the game is healthy, everybody makes money. And so coming up with a model where folks in Milwaukee believe they have the opportunity with the right set of circumstances to win a championship. Because that's what football's got. You know, any season, you know, you can be New Orleans. You know, every time New Orleans wins, that's good for football. And everybody starts out with the idea that they can win. And I think, you know, for the NBA, they're looking for the same thing. I mean, knowing that a team like Memphis can make a run. You know, you want to have a market that allows them to stay together and see if they can make a run again. I think from a branding standpoint, if they can do what you said, you know, what you're suggesting, that's going to be great for the NBA. They're going to look like a much healthier game. The fact that they can be responsible and come up with a deal soon, that's going to be – because the NBA needs to do that. They just don't have the kind of cachet the NFL has. But if they don't, if they got one or two owners that, like, crush them, because the basketball players, they'll fold in a minute. The basketball players will fold in a minute. They're going to fold like basketball wise. Fold. It's going to be some arguing and some throwing some stuff over the table. I just can't see the players. I can't see basketball players holding up that long. I just can't see it. If they lock them out until about December, right around when they got to get them Christmas toys for all them kids. No, for them folks, man, it's going to be some problems. I give up. I'll take the league minimum. So, but if they don't have an owner like that, and David Stern seems to have, from a commissioner standpoint, it feels like Stern has more control with his owners than any other commissioner.
I don't know. I mean, that may be a true statement, but, I mean, Goodell seems to have a pretty good hold and Selig, to my opinion, especially the news that he came out and vetoed the Dodger deal with the McCourts. I mean, Selig seems to be one of the powerful commissioners as well. But a statement I wanted to make was, don't shortchange the NBA Players Association. Was just talking to Billy Hunter, and I think he put it very, very eloquently when he mentioned, you know, obviously right now the owners are attempting to take away guaranteed contracts for basketball players, or at least changing how they work now to give the owners a little bit more flexibility to protect themselves against bad deals and injuries and so forth. And Billy Hunter, he came out and said, you know, Billy Hunter is the president of the Players Association or the Players Union. He came out and said, you know, it's kind of like somebody coming in your house stealing something and they want to, you know, they want to sell it back to you, and you never gave them permission to use it. And so, you know, the owners are, you know, it sounds like in their most recent proposal, they're saying, hey, we're offering some type of guaranteed contract. And all of a sudden, the players are taking a step back and saying, whoa, we didn't know that was ever off the table. So, you know, I think the Players Association is going to be pretty comparable to what the Football Players Association is doing. I mean, they got some pretty strong leaders there. Derek Fisher, I believe, has been the president of the Players Association for a few years and still is. And, you know, I think with him and Hunter, I think they got a formidable group to go up against the owners.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Do you disagree with the owners?
No, I don't. I don't.
See, I don't. This is how many times in a negotiation do you not take the owner's side? I mean, that you take the owner's side, not take the player's side. I mean, it's one of the see it, it, that didn't happen in football. Like everybody looked at owners like they were crazy.
and in some ways, the NBA is further along than the NFL because they do have that rookie scale of how much they can make, you know, the first couple of years, where the NFL owners are, you know, I mean, they're hoping and wishing they can get to something like that where there's kind of a scale, a rookie scale.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't disagree with the NBA owners, but at the same time, you can't take it all away from the players either.
Yeah, I mean, all I got to say is John Conkak. I mean, I can just put the names out there. It just keeps saying it.
Eddie Curry.
Oh, my goodness. That's stealing. Somebody needs to call the police. Call somebody. Call the National Guard. So you just have to keep, I mean, if the NBA owners lose this, I want to know who the lawyer. I mean, I can't even see David Stern losing this one. I don't know how, you know, you're right. I mean, I have a lot of respect for Derek Fisher, a lot of respect for Hunter. I think last time they couldn't really organize amongst the players. Because some of these guys are so much of their individual brand. So it'd be interesting to see how they could pull them all together. They got all their little camps. You know what I'm saying? It's like dealing with a series of corporations, more so than any other sport.
Well, see, that's the issue I have, because it, and unfortunately, I agree that the owners are going to be able to leverage this point I'm getting ready to make.
Mm-hmm.
The common person, I believe, I mean, in general, it's tough for us to associate with professional athletes.
Yeah.
But I think it's a lot easier to associate with NFL players compared to NBA players.
Mm.
Why? In my opinion, because there's this persona out there, there's this thought that, I mean, you got young black kids in general, NBA players, are making so much money without even going to college in some situations.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're only going to college for a year or two. Where in the NFL, you see guys staying 3-4 years in general.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so I think the NBA players are going to have a really tough time combating that issue where with the NFL, I mean, in the court of public opinion, like the game changer always says, the NFL has more footing in that statement.
Yep. I mean, and I think that's the backdrop of it is that and it's the money also connected to production, you know, and how much people are getting based on what they produce. So I think it's all the things you said. But I almost can argue, is there a league with more bad deals than the NBA? More bad contracts than the NBA?
Well, I don't think you can put football in that discussion because, you know, I mean.
Maybe baseball? You
know, perhaps baseball, but I still think they're second place probably to basketball.
And so that's Hunter's challenge. He's got to build an argument to the public that crafts a different understanding. He's got to take it inside the money. Like, this is what it looks like on the surface, but this is what it really means. He got to find some way to counter that.
See, the challenge with basketball is, I mean, you look at football and you look at skill positions on offense.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even on defense, you know, you see statistics. Obviously, receivers, quarterbacks, running backs, statistics speak. But some of these defensive linemen or quarterbacks, and especially linemen, they can make these big bucks. And you don't see fans taking a step back and say, you know what, this guy's only averaging 7.2 points per game. Why is he getting $8 million a year?
Mm-hmm.
Well, in football, you can step away and say, well, they have more of an impact on the locker room. He does a lot of pancake blocks. I mean, he does a lot of communicating on the line of scrimmage. I mean, you know, we have all these reasons we can throw in. Where with the NBA, you look at the guy's stat line. I mean, it literally, you know, my brother always says this. For a basketball player, there is literally a statistic for everything. Bill Russell always says this. When he played, there weren't a whole lot of stats out there that you see. Assist to turnover ratio, blocks, steals. You know, I mean, in his day, you didn't see it. Now, I was looking at Steve Nash's stats. I had to go three pages to look at all his stats for 1 year. Okay? Where in football, you don't have that. So I think it's a little bit easier to justify that, Mike.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
They still want to see production, you know, fans do in football. But at the same time, if an offensive lineman's having a down year or an up year, how do we really know without the media? I mean,
right.
How does the common fan really know? Now, I'm not talking about the coaches that may be listening out there or the people that have watched years and years of sports where they don't always follow the ball. They follow, you know, to see where, you know, if the guards pull it. I'm not talking to you all. I'm talking to the layman fan out there. I mean, how do we really know if a defensive lineman who only gets one or two sacks a year, I mean, how do we know if they're having a good year or a bad year?
Because
it's a little bit easier to see that.
And because we're not in you're not in the grading. You know, they don't make the grading public, right?
Right.
So all of those guys get graded out, but we never see what the grade is, and we don't know what it means. If they posted, like, if everyone had to post a grade after on Monday that every lineman got, then you might see that. Like, this cat's getting graded on every week, and he's still paying them money. You know what I'm saying? So you're right. It's like those stats are public. They're in the paper every night after the game in a way that, you know, linemen who have helmets on, you can't really see. They don't brand them individually. You know, you knew Walter Jones was great for many years, you know, but you didn't know. You knew it because people told you he was. Yeah, he looked like nobody was getting in. You know, it looked like he was doing the right thing every time. You know, and they got helmets on and everything else, so you don't feel up and close and personal. So that's something they definitely got to counter. And NBA players have really gotten this personal branding. So that separates them out even more as individuals because, you know, they really embrace this whole idea of the personal brand and, you know, being their individual brands and, you know, and the importance of that as well. So that creates that even that brings them out there even more in terms of that and into the spotlight. So, yeah, you're right. And that's why I said given all you said, that's why I said if I'm an owner in the NBA, I'm like, we can go for the jugular. we can go for the jugular. You know, I'm doing analysis and projections on what might we lose, the cost-benefit analysis. I'm trying to figure out whether or not it's worth it. You know, if we lock down until February, what will we lose? What would be the potential loss of fans? And you know, there's got to be somebody out there who knows it. Get you one of them MIT cats and run the simulation of it. And if it all come up right, I'm like, I'm looking over at Stern like, we're going for the jugular. I'm going to Tahiti until December. Call me. I'll be back. We'll set our first meeting for December 31st, right before the new year. You know, and see who's still standing. But, you know, they might not go in that direction. And so, but, you know, I'm an owner. I'm thinking about it hard. You know, we may still make the deal before July 4th or the 30th. Or, you know, we may let it go into lockout for a little bit and maybe make the deal by August 1st, have a short camp. You know, maybe go into September, have short camp, you know, something like that. But, you know, I'm going to test the waters, you know, because there are a lot of bad contracts.
I think the worst thing the NBA could do is for the NFL labor dispute to be resolved, and now we got to get ready for an NBA labor dispute. I think if possible, I think it would be in the NBA's best interest to get this thing done well before training camp happens. And if the NFL labor dispute stretches out, to get it done before the NFL. I mean, think about what that would do for the image of the NBA.
Yeah.
You know, well, you know, you got these young kids that they're not professionals. They don't work, they don't appreciate what they have, they have limited skills compared to guys and generations before them. they're getting overpaid. Well, wait a minute. They actually got their labor dispute figured out, you know, 3-4 months quicker than the NFL.
That's now right. That's right. Now what you got to say. Now, there we go. There we go. You know, and that's going to take some fast talking. Right? That's going to take some fast talking to make that happen. And so you're right. I think everything you're saying is right on board. I hope they do it that way. But, you know, and I think they got to realize that the public's fatigued with this labor stuff. They're just fatigued with it. So that's a big part of it. They're just tired of it. You know, so if I'm baseball, I'm like, you know, everybody's lining up, you know. You know, they like you said, they had a chance to kind of see this NFL thing, and I think they get to see the public's tired. You know, economic times are tough. Quit arguing about the stuff. Get it done. So you're right. I think if they get this deal done early, you know, and get it done right, that provides an entirely different image for the NBA. You're right on with that. Well, we've been waiting a little bit. Do you want to go into the special conversation? How do you want to do this?
Yeah, let's do that. I can introduce it out to our listeners. A couple of weeks ago, I was speaking to my nephew, a 16-year-old who has a good grasp of the NBA and just basketball in general. And he posed this question. You know, I think D. Rose is better than Isaiah Thomas. And I really had a tough time convincing him elsewise, you know, otherwise. And so, you know, talking to you and Marcus, we thought about bringing in a segment each week where we kind of bring in a new school player versus an old school player, or at least a player that's retired, that's a legend, to kind of compare them, where there are some parallels with their games, and, you know, some of our younger listeners may have not had the opportunity to watch them, but just kind of compare them and have a debate on who we feel was the better basketball player. And so this week we were going to kick it off with Isaiah Thomas versus Steve Nash. And, you know, if you look at the top five point guards of all time, you typically always see Magic and Oscar on top of every list, typically first or second. But then, rounding out the top five, you start seeing people like Cousy. You start seeing people like Isaiah Thomas, Walt Frazier, even Steve Nash is coming to the discussion. And I'm sure I may be leaving somebody else out there, but typically you see the first two, and then you start to see other players round out that top five point guards of all time. And so, you know, we decided this week to kind of put Steve Nash up versus Isaiah Thomas. So what are your thoughts, Devon?
Well, this, you know, I have to start by, you know, stating that I grew up, you know, as a Piston fan. So I do want to say that. And so, but my remarks in terms of talking about these two players are still about, you know, what I think about them, you know, as basketball players. I'm gonna stay away from the statistics right now, and we'll get back into it. Cause I know you got numbers, and people, I don't think understand and think about how, first of all, dominant Isaiah was as a scorer when he first came in the league. Has the ability, he had the range. He could go mid-range. He'd get to the basket. He could obviously deliver an assist. So offensively, whatever people say about Nash, even if you looked at that, I would say Isaiah, if you, even if you argue that them being one for one, the other piece that Isaiah brought in that I think Nash didn't have, it hasn't demonstrated, was that big game performance. So just away from the numbers, Isaiah had more big game moments as they consider, you know, one of the best small guards ever. But Isaiah delivered in more big game moments. We can't, we can put the 18 points that he scored against the Lakers in one quarter, NBA Finals game, you know, the playoff moments, the winning two championships, being a major figure and making it happen, the leadership. So just on those things, just the eyeball test, having been in a position to watch Isaiah's career and watch Nash's career, that Nash is highly talented. But I think Isaiah is not only talented, but he demonstrated championship character, tenacious, great defender. But I think a very underrated defender as a point guard, was a great defender. Whereas you never even talked about Nash's ability to play defense. People talk about Nash as a liability on defense. You know, so Isaiah played defense, got after people. You would see him getting there mixing up and rebounding. But at the same time, he was a great scorer. He actually sacrificed scoring to win championships, which is different. I mean, people, I think that's part of why this is even an argument. You know, prior to Isaiah, you know, realizing what he had around him as teammates and really thinking about how he could get his teammates to come along with him, he sacrificed scoring. He was averaging well in the 20s for most of his career until they made their championship runs, where then he went down to about 19 points a game. He sacrificed scoring to actually win, you know, and did other things. And so I just think that when you think about just kind of my introductory comments, just looking at the eyeball test, just looking at it from the beginning, I don't think it's even an argument about who's the better player. In some ways, I think that Isaiah is not highly rated enough as it comes down to great point guards of all time. I think he's underrated when you really think about the type of player he was. That's my opening statement.
I guess I have to put the disclaimer out there as well. I too, am a Michigan boy. I grew up in the Bad Boy era. Huge Isaiah Thomas fan. Isaiah Thomas overall had a overall career average of 19 points, 9 assists, and close to 2 steals per game. When you look at Nash, his career averages are a bit lower, where he's averaged about 15-8 over his career. But to Nash's credit, you have to mention that the first 3 or 4 years of his career, he didn't play much. He was behind Jason Kidd in Phoenix, and even his first year or two in Dallas, he only averaged about 20-25 minutes per game. So Nash's best year, statistically speaking, was in 2005-2006, where he averaged 19-10, and then he followed up the following season with 19-12. A distinction between him and Isaiah, two big distinctions, statistically speaking. Steve Nash is a much better three-point shooter than Isaiah Thomas was. Nash is a 43% career shooter from three-point range, while Isaiah Thomas, surprisingly, is only 29%. And that kind of surprised me, but I think you hit the nail on the head. Isaiah had more of a mid-range game.
Yep.
He didn't step out much behind the three-point line, and when he did later in his career, you saw the averages a little bit higher, in the 30% range. The other thing that sticks out for Isaiah is defensively he was a much superior player. He was a better team defender and one-on-one defender. He certainly, you know, wasn't in Joe Dumars category or Dennis Rodman category, but he was a very good defender. He averaged close to 2 steals per game in his career, where Steve Nash has never averaged 1 steal per game in his career. That's kind of the statistics, but obviously in these discussions, there's a lot more out there than the statistics. Some people would argue that the 2 years that Steve Nash won the MVP, that it was somewhat of a downtime for the NBA where, you know, Kobe was injured one of those years. And, you know, I mean, maybe Steve Nash doesn't win an MVP with those numbers in any other year in the NBA history. You know, I've heard that argument being made. And perhaps if Isaiah Thomas played in this generation, maybe he would win a couple of MVPs because he played in the era of Jordan. He played in the era of Dr. J. He played in the era of Kareem. He played the era of Moses Malone. And specifically played in the era with Magic and Larry, which they were racking up MVPs. So in my mind, I think it goes to Isaiah. For a couple different reasons. Early in his career, he averaged 20, 22, 23 points a game, but his team didn't go very far. It wasn't until the 85, 86 season where he had more around him, he gave up a little bit of scoring, and all of a sudden his teams were contenders in the East. It took him a few years to get past the Celtics and ultimately the Lakers, but his team was kind of where you see Phoenix were a couple of years ago. So, I mean, that's kind of my argument for Isaiah. Unlike you, Devon, I do think that it's a reasonable argument. But in my mind, I actually put Isaiah as the third best point guard of all time, behind the Big O and behind Magic.
And usually they have him in that range. Sometimes they have him drop down, you know, below Stockton and Cousy, and, you know, it's always depending on which list you are. They mix him in and out. He had, 25 in that fourth quarter against the Lakers. Isaiah was Mr. Clutch. That's the other piece of it. Big moments, big games. He always there for the moment. So that's kind of that glue piece that I would say about Isaiah that people miss. I mean, Isaiah made more big shots in more big moments than I think. I mean, he's put his team in a position to win. I mean, he's had some great teams around him, but, you know, Nash has some teams around him, but those teams, his team reflected his attitude. And he was battling up against, like you said, I mean, the era where there were some big-time stars. I mean, you know, not only that, but just think about all the other stars, Drexler, Barkley, Olajuwon. You know, just you start to, you know, lay out all the other stars that were there competing for the limelight when he was there. I never forget when he didn't make it on the Dream Team and then went on and hit about 40 on Stockton, got the elbow in the head. I mean, just when you start to evaluate competitiveness, I'm not saying Nash is not a competitor, but when you think about if you put size and competitiveness, think about Isaiah. I mean, Isaiah played with the heart of somebody who was 6'10". I mean, just did not stand down against anybody. And I think that's the other piece that I think you could almost say his competitiveness was Jordan-like. But he didn't have the stature and size. But Isaiah was cutthroat. I mean, the way he set his team up, the politics, how deadly he got out of there. I mean, Isaiah was all about winning. And so I think those are the kind of pieces that you got there. Huh?
Can you name one area of Steve Nash's game that was better than Isaiah's?
What you said, I think three-point range out there.
I would argue that Nash's court vision.
I would say, yeah.
Better than Isaiah's. Now again, I'm talking, you know, we're talking video game stats or you're ranking somebody 0 to 99. I'm talking one guy's got a 98, another guy's got a 96. Okay,
yeah.
So, I mean, it's pretty close, but Steve Nash has a feel of the game where he can get the ball to guys in the right spots, even though they're inferior players, and maybe be very limited players. Think about what he did with Sean Marion.
Yeah.
Where Isaiah, early in his career, he was it. I mean, Kelly Kapuka was his sidekick.
Yes.
Okay.
Ben.
So like when you look at the Derrick Rose right now, where teams can key into him, that's what teams did to Detroit. That's what he did to Isaiah. Nash has never been in a situation where he wasn't playing around very skilled in attribute-specific basketball players, like an Amari, like a Sean Marion. This year is probably the first year where he didn't have that kind of talent around him. And unfortunately, you know, you saw a dip in his numbers. Now, one could argue maybe it was age, but, you know, I mean, you see a dip from 16, 17, 18 down to about 14, what he averaged, where teams were able to key in on him a lot more. What Isaiah had to deal with that consistently early in his career, and his numbers were certainly more dominant than Steve Nash's during those times.
I mean, if you put Isaiah on the teams that Steve Nash had in Phoenix, what do you think would happen?
Well, I think this is why these discussions have so much meat, why they're so fun, because, it's that age-old argument of how do you compare generations? How do you compare eras? And, I mean, if you put Isaiah on that team, I think that team would probably take on a much tougher characteristic.
Yeah.
I mean, like, their mentality would be a lot more hard-nosed. But at the same time, I think a lot of guys like playing with Steve Nash. I'm not sure if all of Isaiah Thomas's teammates like playing with him.
No.
I'm not sure if all of Michael Jordan's teammates like playing with him. You know, I've read a few books about those Piston teams. You know, outside of Mark McGuire and maybe Bill Laimbeer, I mean, a lot of guys, I mean, Isaiah wasn't the most popular Piston.
That's
you
right.
know. During those early years. I mean, you think about guys like Adrian Dantley. You think about other guys, very talented guys, but if they didn't want to put in the work or have put in the energy that Isaiah thought was fit, I mean, they would typically hit the road or it was a pretty rocky relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's tough to compare, but if you put Isaiah on those teams, I think it would be interesting because they didn't have that defensive identity that Isaiah thrived in. So
mm-hmm.
I would lean to say that perhaps Isaiah would bring some of that to the Suns.
Mm-hmm. And he still could have played that open court style. I mean, you think about those Pistons against the San Antonio games. I mean, those games were in the 160s, 170s. They played a couple games against Denver. I mean, they scored some points. they put the balls through the hoop. And I think it's right. I like what you said. If it was video game ratings, when we're arguing these guys, you know, we're saying the difference, you're right, between a 98 and a 96. It's not that different. But they say, you know, it's a slight difference between being good and great, right? It's just a little bit that makes it that much different. And I think the reason why I'm arguing is because so many people have Brandon Isaiah, they don't know because of all the stuff that happened with the Knicks and the stuff that happened with Toronto and the CBA. I think people forget the type of player he was. Sometimes when they try to look back on him. And you always hear Mike Greenberg, who always comes to the defense of Isaiah. So like, people don't realize how great of a player he was. And they forget, you know, his greatness because they get caught up in all that Knicks stuff. But this is a great debate. I mean, I still, you know, I would draft Steve Nash. Now, I'm not saying that. So I want to say that at the end. I would draft Steve Nash.
You know, Steve Nash, he also, I think he had to overcome a lot more where he wasn't highly touted. You know, Isaiah went to Indiana, won a national championship, and I believe he was the second pick, you know, when he came on the draft. I mean, he came in the league averaging 17 and 23 his first 2 years. Where Steve Nash, you know, was 15th pick in the draft, but he was kind of, seen as a project.
Yeah.
You know, he came in the league behind one of the top point guards at that time, Jason Kidd.
Yeah.
And he actually had to leave Phoenix to go to Dallas to really get an opportunity to play. And even there, you know, he didn't slide automatically into the starting role. You know, he was sharing minutes his first year, and the second year, you know, He began to be a starter. So, I mean, he kind of had to earn his role where Isaiah came in as a superstar from day one.
You're right.
And so in that regard, I have a lot of respect for Steve Nash's game because he seemed to really work on his game and get the most out of his ability.
Mm-hmm.
Not the quickest guy, but really used his court savvy to make things happen. We don't hear this a lot at times with black ball players, but Isaiah Thomas was also one of the smartest ball players, you know, in terms of court awareness, offensively, defensively, that this game has ever seen as well.
Yeah, I mean, his basketball IQ is off the chart. And, you know, in terms of that. And I think that's what makes them both compelling players, that they played so much with their heads. They set people up all the time. You know, they are always analyzing games. You always associate them with being a coach on the floor. And I guess I would ask this. If Nash had a different type of coach than D'Antoni in Phoenix, do you think – because I think he still could be effective in different styles. I think he's showing that under Gentry. Do you think that kind of hurt his legacy a little bit, even at the same time that it helped? You understand where I'm going with that? You know, so the style allowed him to get two MVPs was that fool's gold.
I think his numbers were certainly inflated when, you know, every year the Suns and the Warriors, they fight it out to see who's going to be the highest scoring offense in the league.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the most fun books I've ever read was 7 Seconds and Less, which followed the Suns for an entire year. And that was D'Antoni's thing. Let's try to get a quality shot, or if that's not available, any shot in 7 seconds or less. And so when you look at Nash's numbers, you can't help but think, well, if he wasn't in that system, maybe he's not averaging 19. Maybe he's averaging 16 during his best year. Maybe he's not getting 11, 12 assists, you know, a game. Maybe he's getting 9 or 10, you know. So I think that hurts him. Historically, I don't think it'll hurt him. I think he's still a first-ballot Hall of Famer. I think whenever they come out with a top 50, or it'll probably be top 75 players of all time, you know, I think he makes that list. But in terms of this debate against some of the better point guards, you know, he doesn't win that numbers debate, because you throw any other top 5 point guard or top 10 point guard into that debate, you have to add a couple of numbers, like a couple of points, couple of assists to their numbers,
mm-hmm.
which are already probably superior to Steve Nash's to start with.
Yeah. And I think when you look at the guys who are ahead of them, I mean, I think that output that they had per game, I think the only person that he might rival in statistics over a lifetime, but I don't know if he has the number, the all-star numbers, is probably Stockton. Stockton's got him on assists, but he scored more points than Stockton and averaged about the same amount of rebounds. So you're right. I think when you start to show basic numbers, and that's why I say with Isaiah's numbers, you know, what you're seeing is really towards the end of his career, his average coming down. Because if you just looked at it prior to the run, if he, you know, pushed the scoring, his average would be up higher, well over 20. You know, and so, you know, he sacrificed a lot there later in his career for winning, I think at the end of the day, that's what it's all about.
Right.
Well, I like this segment, man. We're going to keep working it, you know, especially when we get my boy Game Changer in the booth. I know he had a whole bunch of things he wanted to contribute to this, and all I can say is about that is, you know.
Can't wait.
For Game Changer to be part of this. You know, thinking about the NBA, one of the things we're going to talk about is, we said, you know, we didn't want to get into LeBronism and everything else. We want to just focus on, because it's a team game. So this week we were going to say we got a chance to breathe. Now we're trying to project out to next year, and we want to start with the Heat. And start with kind of looking at next year in Dallas, and what we might think about, you know, what do they need to do as we try to get ready for next year. And because these things always center around the Heat, let's just start with Dallas. Let's start with the champs. You know, when you think about where do you go from here, it's interesting. Everybody's, like, framing the Mavericks like, I heard a couple of people, Kyle heard talking today, like, you know, most teams don't win it the way the Mavericks did, outshoot people and everything as if they didn't play any defense. You know, and so people are, like, framing them like the one-hit wonders, like they're the Golden State Warriors, like they're the Washington Bullets, right? Like they're the Seattle Supersonics, never to be seen again. But when you look at them, they won with one of the better players sitting on the bench.
Right.
Right? One, even in that series, was Hayward going down with an injury. So as you start to think about next year with Dallas, I mean, where do you see them going? What do you think they need as they move forward?
Well, I think they have two glaring needs, or at least transactions they need to make. One is Caron Butler. They don't think they can get a comparable guy to take his spot because Butler's going to be a free agent.
Mm-hmm.
You got to re-sign him or bring in somebody who has a similar skill set and can bring that to the table like he can.
Mm-hmm.
Tayshaun Prince, well, you know, he's a free agent. He's a guy I think brings a lot of the same things that Caron Butler can bring, but given the choice between Tayshaun and Butler, I would take Butler 6 days out of seven.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I mean, like the game changer will probably bring up, it has a lot to do with whatever happens with this labor dispute and trying to figure out the salary cap and if there's going to be a hard cap or a soft cap, because that might make some of the decisions for this team. Secondly, they need more depth on the front court. Brendan Haywood, I've never been a big fan of his game, but for this team, he was exactly what they needed.
Mm-hmm.
If they could bring in somebody who may be a little bit more consistent, that they can spot Chandler. Because, you know, in the games that Miami won, or at least dominated most of those games in the finals, one of the common themes was Chandler got in early foul trouble. And there were games when Brendan Haywood came in and gave them quality minutes, and there were a couple of games where he was injured, and they couldn't do that. So I think they need a little bit more front court depth.
We got hit by the storm. We got hit by a storm. We got hit by something. You back in with me, Phil?
Yep, I'm here with you.
Yeah, I don't know what happened to us. We got kicked out of this thing, but we're back in, ready to go. Better than ever. And where should we get back into thought? What was going on here before we got cut off? I think you were making a point.
We were armchair GM and the Mavericks, and
yep.
My 2 points were the Mavericks need to re-sign Caron Butler, or if they can't afford him, go out and get a guy like Tayshaun Prince or somebody who can fill that role like Butler did. Secondly, they need more front court depth. So whether it's Brendan Haywood, I think they just signed him to a pretty freshly new contract. So either try to move him or keep him and perhaps bring in somebody else that can give you some minutes in the front court. And perhaps it's the kid that played well from France.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps it's him, if they have enough confidence in him, but they need more front court depth, because that does a couple of things. That helps Chandler be more aggressive out there when he knows that if he gets a couple of early fouls, you know, they have somebody they can bring in that can still give that team a defensive identity.
And I agree with everything that you said. And what I also would like to see him do is maybe get a backup point guard to Kidd that had a little bit more size and can be physical and get in. You know, give him a little bit more scoring. Someone like your guy Miller who played with Portland. You know, someone like that who can get in, you know, different than a J.J. Barea, but, you know, someone who could get in, spell, still be a defensive presence, and, you know, get into the paint. I'd like to see them build a little bit more depth in that backcourt as well with someone who can make some things happen off dribble when a play breaks down. I think that only makes the rest of the fellas on the court, makes Jet more effective down the stretch. I think it'll help Dirk continue to get easy shots. So in addition to, you know, building some front court, I like to see them, you know, have someone with a little bit more size who can spell Kidd. A little bit younger, but, you know, can get in and might, you know, and provide some kind of physical presence for him defensively. I would like, you know, if as you were talking about Tayshaun and Butler, and I love Butler, but Tayshaun gives you a guy that can do a lot of different things. He can get out on the break. He can defend. He gives you a lot of options on defense. You can play a lot of different combinations with Tayshaun. You know, he's a decent ball handler. He can rebound. He gets a little rebound. So, you know, that I think that helps Dirk out a little bit because he's not afraid to get in there and get on the glass and do some things. You know, if you're going to play that zone, I mean, I think, you know, he would be great in zone as well. I think he can cover space. So, I mean, I don't know if I would go 6 out of 7 days of the week. I might go 5 out of 7, 4 out of 7. But I like that. If we think about the Heat, what do you think about the Heat?
Oh, my goodness. I think of the analogy that I used a few weeks ago. Spoelstra is kind of like that chef on Hell's Kitchen, where Chef Ramsay's got, I mean, he's got everything in the freezer. You know, my wife and I, we watch that show all the time, and I'm always amazed, from somebody who enjoys cooking and unfortunately eating too much, you know, I'm always impressed with all the stuff they have on hand. You know, their cupboards, their freezers, their refrigerators, they are full. So using that with the Heat are full with main course type additions. They have every kind of meat you want. You know, you got your fillets, you got your fish, you got your chicken, you got your veal, any kind of meat you have with the big three. What they need to do is fill in those complimentary pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think last year they had to take whatever they could get. And so you saw a lot of older guys, past their prime, playing for the, you know, the veteran minimum. So you had your Juwan Howards, your Big Z's, your McGlores. I think this year, assuming that this labor stuff can get figured out and they kind of know what kind of flexibility they'll have on the new cap rules, I think this may be the year where they will have that to qualify for that veteran minimum, veteran exception, that may come in for that $5 or $6 million a year, just a chance to play with these guys. So I actually think that the Heat will be in the best position for a team that may not have a ton of flexibility underneath mm-hmm. the cap. But if if I'm Pat Riley right now, I'm rooting for some kind of soft cap and some kind of veteran exception for that to stay.
Mm-hmm.
If those two things go, the Heat can be in a really tough position where they may even have to get rid of one of their big three.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I guess to answer your question, what do they need? Obviously, they need something more down low.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Kenyon Martin, he's a free agent. You know, Joel Anthony, he brings something to the table defensively. He can guard pretty much, you know, a four or five, but he's really limited offensively. Haslam, if Haslam plays the way that he played during the playoffs, we could be looking at this team winning 65 to 70 games.
Mm-hmm.
But they also need more consistent perimeter players at the point guard as well, which I think they may get with Chalmers having another year underneath his belt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm looking at just some bigs that might be available, unrestricted. You got Glenn Davis, Big Baby. You got Nazi Muhammad. You got Prince Billa available. You got Scalabrini, but we don't know about Scalabrini. Kurt Thomas. A guy like Kurt Thomas is a guy that could play for the Heat.
That's right.
You know, that's a playoff guy.
Right?
That's right. You know, you pick him up. He's right in the locker room. You know, would be really good for them. You know, a guy like Brian Cardinal, he's an unrestricted. You know, Dallas might not sign him back, but he's a banger. You know what I'm saying? You know, you might not lose him all season. He's a banger. You got Kenyon Martin. You got Nene. There. So I'm just kind of going through. You got Chris Wilcox. That's another guy who get on the glass.
You know what the Heat need?
Huh?
The Heat need Steve Kerr, John Paxton, a young Craig Hodges.
Yeah.
They need guys who can shoot and make it open shots and space the court, do what Mike Miller was supposed to do.
Yeah.
If they do that, and, I mean, these guys can even be defensive liabilities to a certain degree because guess what? Dwayne Wade and LeBron James, you know, if you have a D-Rose, if you have somebody like Chris Paul, those guys can guard them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it would be nice if they had a point guard that could make open shots, you know, and defend other good point guards, but, I mean, that doesn't necessarily have to be the situation. They need guys that can make open shots.
Yep. And part of that is, you know, could you get a Peja Stojakovic? A guy who can just slide to a spot. All he do, you don't lose the opportunity to shoot. You just can shoot. Rakhmanovic is another shooter. I mean, there's some shooters out there. Dunleavy might not be bad in that situation. You know, he's kind of a glue guy, but he can shoot.
I like Dunleavy a lot better than the other two guys. Peja, I mean, the thing about Peja, man, is you got to guard somebody else. You know, I mean, if you have a guard who can shoot, you know, I mean, they're going to be serviceable defensively. Peja, man.
Well, I'm gonna throw you a couple that here's a guy who's demonstrated he can knock down outside shots and provide you with defense. How about a Shane Battier?
Absolutely.
Who I think, you know, he can provide you because he can spot up and hit that jump shot, but he also can be part of your defensive principles. He can defend. Here's a couple other names. Michael Redd.
Yeah.
Earl Boykins. Earl can fill it up. He's a small guy, you know, but he'll battle. But a Michael Redd is another guy that who can fill it up. You know, he's coming back from that injury. But does he have anything in the tank? He might be a guy you can get, you know, because, you know, he's at a point in his career where he wants to win. And those are the kind of guys you want to look for, a guy who is willing to take. You got Jason Richardson. I don't think they have the money for him. Capono.
Back to Miami. Now, that's a guy.
Yeah, Capone's like a tease. You know, I almost put like Capone. You know, because the Cavs got Capone and mm-hmm. thought he'd be a perfect piece to go with LeBron.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, that guy is just hit and miss. You know, I could see the same thing happening with Mike Miller that happened with Capone. Just
mm-hmm.
inconsistent. An
mm-hmm.
inconsistent shooter. I mean, what's more worthless than an inconsistent shooter? Well, that's all they can do. You know, I mean, it's like an inaccurate bowler, as my dad
mm-hmm.
always says.
Mm-hmm.
You know, an inaccurate bowler is useless.
Inaccurate bowler. That's
yeah.
what you said, is useless. Wow. Well, I might have the modern day Steve Kerr.
Okay.
But he's a little bit bigger. It's Steve Novak.
Wow. He's getting
unrestricted.
Some good minutes.
Unrestricted. He can shoot.
Yep.
He can seriously shoot. He never seen. He can shoot. He is what you call a professional shooter. He's shooting his sleep. He'll shoot, but he can shoot. Is anybody ever going to question the fact that he can shoot or not? So they got some people out there. They think, and he's kind of guy that's kind of out of the box. He's still kind of growing, but he might. You know, he might not be a bad cat. If, you know, I can see the Spurs trying to keep him. You know. But he's a guy that, Barbosa's out there. That's a guy that I think I'd like to see. I mean, I don't know if he has a player option, but that's a guy I actually would like to see down in Dallas, you know,
yeah.
To add one more thing in the mix. I think a Barbosa down in Dallas would be nice. But there's some people out there. I mean, you got to do your homework and see what you can – you can do it. I mean, there's a couple of professional shooters out here that I think, might help them out. The other thing I think they need to do is go ahead and just let they did quit playing around with the point guard position and just, get some stability there because I think they just killing themselves. Right now, I think they should just go with Mario Chalmers. I mean, he demonstrated in the playoffs, if nothing else, he demonstrated he got heart. And he always been able to make a big shot. I think they just need to let him settle in on that point guard position. He played defense well enough. I think they need to just let him settle in and grow into that point guard position. I don't know how you feel.
I think he's still developing, and I like his game. You know, he can handle the ball when needed. He can actually take guys off the dribble when needed. I mean, he's deceptively, got a nice first step to get
mm-hmm.
to the rack. But he's not a ball dominant point guard.
Yeah.
Which, from what I see working with the Heat, that's what they need. They don't need a guy that's going to be ball dominant. Where like Barbosa, I think everything about Barbosa would work well and. Miami, but he likes the rock a lot. I mean, he likes to dribble the air off the ball, like my high school coach used to say. You know, they already got a few guys that can do that down in Miami, so they don't need that. But, I mean, you got a guy like Shannon Brown that's going to be a free agent. You know, Nick Young. But the thing with younger free agents, I mean, they're at the point, I mean, even a Flalo for Denver, I mean, they're at the point where they're ready to get paid.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, they're not probably going to take that, you know, $4 or $5 million exception. I mean, even if they qualify for it, I mean, they're going to want a more long-term type of deal.
Well, that's what I thought about Barbosa down in Dallas, because I think he'd be a better fit in Dallas. With them, which I think you're right about. They got to look for somebody who's a little bit. That's why I think someone like a Novak is good because
he might be the kind of kid that's making decisions. I can see he's the kind of kid that wants to win. And he can see an opportunity. You might be able to convince him to come and play. The other question, do you break up the big three?
We only got 13 minutes left on the show. We don't.
I'm gonna throw it out there. We can tease the crowd and then come on back at a later date.
I think if you break up the big three, you almost have to break up the big two.
Yeah.
Because they're, you know, if you put LeBron and D-Wade together, I mean, they're two of the five best basketball players in the world, in my opinion.
Yeah.
You know, two of the best 10 in everybody's list.
Mm-hmm.
But they're so similar.
Yeah.
And, I mean, but to their credit, we saw them evolve so much from game one in the preseason
mm-hmm.
to their run in the playoffs where they were able to play together and complement each other, but typically not at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing with Bosh is, in my mind, you're almost better having a good perimeter player and a good post player opposed to having two dominant, ball-dominant perimeter players.
That's right.
Even if they're great. And I think with one of them gone, you probably see Bosh averaging 25 a game. Given the choice, I'd keep them together. I'd keep them together, give them the choice. But that's the thing. They may not have a choice.
Yeah, and that's the thing about it. If the deal comes out the wrong way, they might be like, that's the only way they can make it happen. You're always going to find somebody who's desperate to get a ring. And will sacrifice because, you know, they want to get paid, but they're also at a point right now they can get out. But, yeah, I think you run with the big three for one more year because, you know, you're just now catching stride. But I think if they make some of the moves that we're talking about, I think Keith Chalmers in the lineup, if you can add some of the people out there, some good folks out there who are unrestricted who could add some value to the squad in Miami right away. And there's some bigs on it. I mean, they can add some more bodies if they needed to as well through free agency if somebody's willing to take. Especially so, I mean, a guy like Prince Dilla, you know, something like that, a guy who's a shot blocker. You know, to give you something more in the middle. I mean, think about that. I mean, they have more of a shot blocking presence in the middle, you know, how much more that makes them dominant defensively and getting out on breaks. So, I mean, that's a kind of quiet signing. That's the kind of signing that, you know, could be a difference maker because you got a big that can be active around the rim for you. Help you get out there and get some more breaks. So, I mean, Riley's got enough to work with, we got to watch the clock. What's going on?
I got one for you. I mean, we haven't talked much about the upcoming draft yet, but Jimmer Fredette would look real good in the Heat uniform.
Oh, he would, because he could spot up.
Yeah.
And he could hit the standstill jump. But he also got enough funk in his game, he'd be all right with the big three.
That's right.
You know, he could be a guy that would be really good in the Heat uniform. I mean, people are predicting, and we didn't talk much about the draft as much, but, I mean, that is coming up this week. We don't have much time left, but you know, what are you thinking about the draft? I mean, they're talking about, you know, Kyrie Irving and talking about the possibility of Williams going to Cleveland. That would put Cleveland right back on the map, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there's been some talk about Minnesota maybe getting rid of that second pick.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a lot of reports of the Cavs trying to get rid of that fourth pick.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think that'll probably be more in play with teams that are trying to move up,
mm-hmm.
you know, like the Miamis, like the Lakers. I just really like this Derek Williams kid, man. I mean,
yeah.
I I see him as a more explosive version of Lamar Odom.
Yeah.
Perhaps not able to handle the rock as well, but somebody who's 6'9", you know, maybe even will fill out to 6'10", can guard a couple different positions, has a nice mid-range game, can probably develop a three-point range. Another kid that I'm really looking at as well is Leonard out of San Diego State.
Yeah.
So one of the things Marcus the Game Changer kind of taught me when we went to go see the NCAA tournament this year, you know, I asked him, you know, hey, Juwan Johnson, do you see this guy? You know, I mean, I saw this guy play, and I'm thinking, man, this guy's going to be a lottery pick. And Marcus made the astute point of, well, you know, if I'm a GM, I'm thinking, what more could you ask the guy to develop to do? You know, I mean, he's already got a decent perimeter game. He's got a decent game on the block. You know, he's only going to put so much more weight on his body. I mean, you can't really expect him to develop into much more.
Mm-hmm.
Where you look at a guy like Leonard, who's got everything but a consistent jump shot.
Mm-hmm.
If that kid gets that, I mean, Steve Fisher said it, that he has potential to be one of the best players, if not the best professional player he's ever coached.
Mm-hmm.
And that's saying a lot. I mean, you're talking about a guy who's coached Glenn Rice, who's coached Weber, who's coached Jalen Rose. I mean, that's saying quite a bit.
Yeah. And you're looking for that upside, you know.
Yeah.
You're looking for guys that can, you know, who can make that happen. I think Leonard, and depending on where they got him, you know, and I think, you know, people like, you know, Kemba Walker, I still think is going to bring something to the table, and I don't think people need to sleep on him. I just think there's something about knowing how to win, and he's a winner. But I think I think most people think he might have maxed out his game in college, but I think he has another gear to go to. I think the NBA game is only going to show something else. The open floor game is going to be good for him. So I'm interested to see how he does. It's generally for that and the way they've been talking about him. Even though I watch him, I think he's a great player. I always thought he would be a high second round type guy. I don't know why. You know, they got him late, projected, Utah's got a big push on him. And, I mean, people are thinking he's going to take it because – of you know, what it would mean in terms of marketing, but I on the list I've seen him in the 20s, you know, I think that's more where he needs to be. But you know, that plays for a team like a Miami. What
he's been flying up the charts. They now have him projected to be a top 10 pick now.
Yeah, which I haven't figured out if he can. You know, you got to be able to play some defense. You know, he's limited on the floor. What you can do with him, you know. You can't have him down the stretch because, you know, people can isolate on him. So that's, you know, but maybe he might demonstrate something different. You know, maybe somebody's seeing something different from him. But I think, you know, he's a liability on defense from what
you can see. You can't take him at three. Utah can't take him at three. I mean, they trade, get out of that pick, go down to 10, but you cannot take Fredette at three, no matter how much – you want him in Utah.
Well, I think Utah is set at what? Utah's at what? 12 or what was it? Where are they projected? Utah's at 11, right? Oh, they got the number 12 pick.
They got the third pick from the Nets, and then also I believe they have another pick in the first round at 12. Yeah, they have another pick at 12.
So I think they're looking at the 12th pick for them that they might take him there. Which is, another guy that I like I've seen on this list is Chris Singleton. I love the defense that guy plays. He's tough. He fits in what you said about Marcus. Marcus was saying, you know, where can a guy grow? This is a guy that can grow. If he can expand a little bit on his game a little bit, but he's from a defensive standpoint, and some of the things he does, I mean, this is a guy I think that has untapped potential as well.
Yeah, we actually got a chance to see him play up close, and I mean, this is a big kid. He's got a huge wingspan as well, and he can get up and down the court in a hurry.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes. And defensively, you're right. I mean, we saw him lock down some people. I mean, he's you know, kind of unpolished in some ways, but you see flashes.
Yep.
You see flashes of what he can be.
Yeah. You know, if he could be a Posey type, I think he has more than a Posey. He has more athleticism. He can do more. I think he has more potential there. I mean, that's a guy that's I think he has a big upside in the league. And kind of fitting that definition to where that potential growth can come, I think he's a guy that would be another dark horse in the league. So I know we're gonna be analyzing the draft next week. It's gonna be off the hook for us and being able to do that. So we'll have a lot to kind of reflect on once the picks are made, and then we can kind of talk about our next set of teams, knowing what draft picks they have. We'll project this week. Which two old school and new school guys we'll talk about. We'll talk about, who else is on the clock in terms of teams, kind of getting ready for the NBA, doing a couple teams every week and kind of breaking them down. And we'll have a little bit more information next week. But as we get ready, we only have about a minute left here. I'll let you, Phil, say something to the people.
Next week, old school matchup, D-Wade versus Clyde the Glide Drexler.
Woo!
That is going to be a battle. Clyde, you pick Clyde and D-Wade. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
All the young people are saying, what do you mean?
Right.
What do you mean? that's not even a battle. That's a first round knockout.
That's right.
Not so fast, young folk.
Right.
You all said right. Clyde to Clyde to D-Wade. Oh,
right.
My.
Might have to get the coach, Hubie Brown, to weigh in on that one.
Oh, we're going to have to get the coach, Hubie Brown, to weigh in on that one. What you got to understand is, we got to look at possession. We got to look at defense. We got to break it all down. That's going to be a good one. I can't even, I don't need a week to think about that one. I'm going to need a week to think about that one. That's a juicy one. If you want to get in next week, make sure you get in. You can always call us at 347-989-0844. Check us out. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter, Sports Guys. Hit us up on our blog on realsportsguys.com. Like we said, until next week, Renegade Radio, we're out. Yeah.